Really lovely to be here. Thank you for joining me. And I want to welcome, of course, everybody who is comes to Wednesday Sangha regularly. And if there's anybody who's joining Spirit Rock today for the first time, a really big welcome to you too. I'm glad that you've chosen to be here. And for those of you who I know, thank you for joining me. It's so sweet to see you. And for those of you I don't know, I'm really happy to get to meet you and that you are here today. I want to acknowledge that I am calling in today from McKinleyville, California, which is about 300 miles north of San Francisco on the coast in the Redwoods, the unceded land of the Wiat. And it's still June gloom here. It's still gray and about 55 degrees. And sometimes it feels like there's one season up here in Humboldt County. Anyway, I feel a little bit of aversion and a little graspiness of, is the sun ever going to come out during the day? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe not right now. The other thing I want to acknowledge that I really appreciate that Carlita does every time we come together is names our time as a two-hour retreat. And it is. And to welcome yourself into however you think of as retreat time. Not everybody can take time out of their lives for a multi-day retreat. And this is just as good. It is a different flavor. It's a different way of practicing, but you're giving yourself time, the gift of some time that's dedicated for practice. So let it be that. This is this retreat. It really is that. So as we go through the morning, we'll start shortly with an arriving meditation. I'll offer some Dharma thoughts. We'll have a longer meditation, a longer Dharma talk, all within that time to talk with each other. And that's how our morning will go. The other thing I want to say is that there is a way that I have found to listen to a Dharma talk, to be present in a retreat. And it's with this quality of trusting that you're going to get what you need, that you can just be here, let the words, let the meditations meet you right where you are, let it flow through you. And if you have the inclination of, oh, I want to get that resource, oh, I have to take notes, see if you can let that go. And trust that you're going to get what you need. The talk today will be recorded and it'll be up on Dharma Seed later. You just go to Dharma Seed and to Spirit Rock, to centers, choose Spirit Rock, go to talks, and you can search under Heidi Born and you'll get it. So in that way, it helps you be that much more present and just not even worrying about the resources. And one of the things that we're going to do as a way to support you not worrying about that is we're not going to offer a transcription of the resources as we go. And so sometimes we do that. Carlita will post a poem or something that I've said or a link to a resource. I'm not going to do that today. Just going to welcome us all just to be here. And so then you can go back to the talk and listen for it if you like. Okay? So give that a try and see how that feels. If you're a person who takes lots of notes, and I say this because I was that person. I did that for a very long time until I realized it was distracting me and it actually wasn't supporting my practice. And so then I go back to the recordings and take notes then. And that's fine because that's the space I want to be in, that study space. All right. Any questions on any of that? Okay. Let's move into just simply arriving here, coming into an arriving meditation, which I love so dearly as a way to transition from our non-retreat practice into retreat practice. If you'd like to close your eyes, do that. If not, just have a gentle, soft gaze downward. Let the breath arrive and go. dropping the shoulders, softening the face and unhinging the jaw. Arriving and settling and landing right here in this breath, in this body. Noticing the posture of the body, whether you're seated or standing or reclining. There's nothing special to do. Breathe and know you're breathing. Sense the body and sense the body. And invite the mind to begin to quiet a little bit. And inviting the heart to be here with you. Perhaps offering yourself an internal bow of recognition and appreciation for coming to Sangha today. We'll sit quietly for a few minutes. You may notice that there's somewhere in the mind-heart or somewhere in the body that has some sort of tone of discomfort or unpleasant. Maybe some constriction or a place in the body that literally is hurt, is painful. Sending a little softening breath to whatever may be calling your attention that has a quality of unpleasant to it. There's softening there, any amount. And also noticing where in the body or the heart mind is comfortable. There may be some warmth or softness that's right here, right now, that's easy to be with. Letting your mind rest there for a couple of minutes. The experience that awareness holds, a full spectrum of experience, from the most pleasant down through maybe a little neutral and even the unpleasant. It can all be true at the same time, being here. And then remembering, what was your motivation to join Sangha today? That inner knowing, something that said, I'm going to go do that. Maybe this is something you do every week. Maybe it's new. But letting that inspiration, let that come to the surface so you can know it a little bit deeper. Trusting it, that place that says, yes, this is what I'm doing this morning, or whatever time it is for you. And is there an intention for practice this morning or beyond? And letting that be here with you also. Okay, coming back. Before coming here, or actually just about every time when I am preparing to teach somewhere, to sit in this seat, whether it's for Spirit Rock or elsewhere, I spend a little bit of time thinking about, what's happening in my life right now, and what are the teachings that help me meet whatever is happening in my life. And because it's important to me that these teachings come alive and why they matter. And certainly there are teachings that I've heard or read or listened to over the years that go right past me. That there are just, this is just how it is, because the volume of teachings that we have can't land all the time. And then there are teachings that really do land, that have been very informative to me, and that I find to be a continual source of support and a resource. So part of my preparation always is, what are the teachings that are alive for me right now, and how are they showing up? And also, not only what are the teachings that are alive for me right now, but what have been the teachings that seem to keep flowing through, that have a regular current and are a source, a regular source of support for me. So that's what I did. And of course, I come to this big foundational teaching that the Buddha described. What he taught was, I teach suffering and the end of suffering. That's always the overarching teaching. And I remember when I first heard that, I thought, wow, that's interesting. Like, you know, I gotta find out what he meant by that. So what are the causes of greed and ill will and confusion or fogginess, ignorance, delusion, whatever word you want to use? And what releases the grip of greed and ill will and delusion? That's another way of looking at how do we distill out and tease out, I teach suffering and the end of suffering. Suffering being defined as the imperative in the mind that things should be other than they are, whether we have graspiness or push away or we're not seeing clearly. They said, so find out what causes those poisons and don't do it. Find out what releases them and do it. And it's not as easy as a Nike ad, right? It's definitely not as easy as just do it or just don't do it. And that's why we show up here over and over and over again. And that our formal meditation practice, when we really stick with it, my experience is that I can really see how my heart mind works. I can see the habits of what goes on. And that's why this formal practice is so critical, not to mention that it cultivates a certain steadiness and balance. It helps regulate the nervous system. It has so many different benefits to it. But what I'm thinking about today that I want to talk about are primarily the first two foundations of mindfulness, mindfulness of the body and mindfulness of Vedana, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, and how that affects so much of what we experience, how we think, what we say, what we do, how we experience our lives. And in this first foundation of mindfulness, the Buddha said, there is a body. Just that alone, those four words, there is a body. If you think about that, it's huge. And within, then he said, and within this fathom long body, this within this fathom long body and mind is found all of the teachings. We can take any one of the foundations of mindfulness, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, Vedana, mindfulness of the mind, emotions and thoughts, and the fourth foundation of mindfulness, mindfulness of all the ways we experience, all the experiences. And within that, we find, we can take it apart, the teachings on impermanence, the teachings on dukkha, the teachings on how profoundly interconnected everything is, we can find them all. We can find the greed, the ill will, the delusion. And so we cultivate a certain amount of what the word that's so great is, tatramajatata, the ability to be right here, there in the middleness, tatramajatata. So thinking about this body, we can get very specific with it. All of the different systems that are literally in this body that are required to stay alive. I know I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but this is one of these teachings that I think is very valuable to keep coming back to. That how does the skin work? How does respiration, digestion, circulation, the endocrine system, the bones, the muscle? It is extraordinary that all of these systems exist and that they are integrated, that when one isn't working quite as well as another, there's a consequence to it. They do compensate for each other. All of the different ways in which we can see how this body goes through cycles of illness and wellness, how it continues to age throughout our lives. We all know this, but do you experience dukkha in the body? What is your experience in your own body? What is the emotional experience of this body? What are the ways we love it? What are the ways we push it away? What are the ways we don't really know it? And this is what our practice helps us to do. There's this great piece that Frank Ostasevsky wrote about in his book, The Five Invitations. And what he said was, what if you could make a big cardboard cutout, life-size cardboard cutout of your body? You know those, you ever see those life-size cutouts of really famous people? Sometimes, you know, they stick them in their windows or their doorways of their houses. You think, oh, Obama's at that person's house. I remember the first time I saw one of those and I did a double take. Okay, so what Frank says is, what if we get this big, huge cardboard photo cut out of ourselves and then take it to get laser cut into a jigsaw puzzle? And so all of a sudden, we become this jigsaw puzzle and we're going to put ourselves back together because here's this big, huge box of cardboard pieces. What would you do first? Would you build your outline? Would you build your face? Would you build your arms or your feet or your heart? What do you want to include right away in how you relate to your own physical body? More importantly, what do you leave out? Are there pieces you don't want to see? Are there pieces that are painful that you'd like them to be other than they are? Are there pieces that you'd pick up that piece and say, I have no idea where this belongs? Because that's true. That's true. There are parts of ourselves we know and love. There are parts of ourselves that we reject. There are parts of ourselves we actually don't know. And there are literally parts of ourselves we can't feel. Like we don't really feel our lymph system moving around. Maybe some people do. I don't know what that feels like. So I don't want to make any assumptions. But what are those parts? So the Buddha says there is a body, and in this fathom-long body, all of the teachings exist. The truth of the impermanence, the dukkha, the not quite rightness. And we certainly live in a culture that we continually get the message that this body is not quite right. And how painful that is. The dukkha that comes from this body is not quite right. Right according to whom? Right? Can we go up against that and say, right according to whom? Because that's where the damage is done. And then there's another piece. Aside from in this fathom-long body, there is a body, all the teachings arise. I believe that this next teaching is attributed to one of Jack Kornfield's teachers, Munindraji, but I'm not 100% sure about that. Sit and know you're sitting, and the whole of the Dharma will be revealed. I love that. Sit and know you're sitting, and the whole of the Dharma will be revealed. It's basically saying the same thing, that if you know where you are, you know, sit and know you're sitting is a metaphor for whatever you're doing, know what you're doing. When you're washing the dishes, wash the dishes. When you're sweeping the floor, sweep the floor. Because when you're that present with your life, with your experience, the truth of change shows itself. Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral is right there. The heart can show up, the ways we love, the ways we don't love. So when we sit down in this practice and really attend to what we are aware of, we're fully present. And when we bring some kindness to this, some compassion, we have more capacity to say, yeah, it's like this right now. And how it is right now might be really beautiful. You know, oftentimes we can focus on what is painful and what is difficult, but we also need to focus on what is going well, what is right, what is beautiful, because that is true too. So I want to read you a piece from another Dharma teacher. Her name is Kate Lilo Wheeler, and this is called Appreciating Your Aliveness. We only get one body in this life, the one we are each endowed with right in this moment. Please begin by giving yours the respect it deserves. Did you realize every atom in it is 14.5 billion years old? All bodies are part of matter created at the Big Bang 10 billion years before the Earth appeared. Can you imagine that there were 10 billion years before the Earth appeared? Yes, your overall body is composed of about 7 octillion venerable atoms. That's a 7 with 27 zeros after it, mostly produced by exploding stars. You are literally stardust. We are stardust, and so is everything around you. The water in this body seems to flow into your mouth from a fountain or a glass and then out again through pores and orifices. But like all the waters of the earth, no one knows where it came from. Perhaps a comet's tail, it's said. And if you have gold fillings, your teeth carry a share of all of the gold that exists in the universe, for the number of gold molecules is finite. Your body is not just mineral and elemental. No, it's vividly alive, as anyone who's ever danced, had a sore throat, made love, or stubbed a toe knows this. Try to sense the skin around your body. Feel how alive it is. For this, you can thank a single-celled creature. All the Baroque variety of life on Earth is considered to come from a common tiny ancestor who appeared about 4 billion years ago. Again, no one knows quite how. And still today, on a cellular level, basic functions like respiration look similar in plants and animals. And so does our DNA. We humans share about half of our genetic information with plants. We truly aren't very far away from anything. Our salty blood remembers oceanic origins. The structure of our spines and ribs was first developed by fish. Population geneticists agree that all of us are literally one human family. What would our world be like if everyone acted on this truth? Yet as connected as we are, there is astonishing diversity within being human. Each person is utterly distinct. Our fingerprints, toe prints, and tongue prints will never be reproduced. But surely it is the brain that is our most fabulous body part. Scientists believe the human brain is the most complex object in the universe, capable of making 100 trillion neural connections. I don't even know how to relate to that. What's 100 trillion neural connections? Lay all your neurons end to end and they'll reach to the moon and back. Awake, asleep, or dreaming, your brain is active day and night, a magic lantern. Its neurons interact in constantly shifting patterns of electrical energy and are deeply attuned to others and the outside world. Not only that, but your brain is capable of self-awareness. Brain and body are inseparable collaborators, producing the symphony that fully absorbs us. This is the wonder of a life. How amazing that we can be amazed. There is a body. Mine and yours and everybody else's together. We're breathing the same air. It's said that water, or that the body is something like 70% water. So think about the watershed that you live nearby, or the source of water. My watershed is the Mad River. That means my body is 70% Mad River. It's kind of amazing to think about that. So I love that piece, because we are, this body is so connected with everything else, and it teaches us, I think it teaches me just about everything. So let's move into our meditation. Finding a way to be in your body that suits you. Letting it be comfortable. I'm going to offer a little bit of guidance today to work with this experience of this body. So if your eyes are closed, or if your eyes are open, becoming aware of visual perception, perhaps the quality of light, maybe there are shadows, maybe the movement of light and shadow, or even color behind the eyelids, or whatever you notice with this soft gaze. The fact that you can perceive visually at all. And people who don't have eyesight also have some sort of visual perception, it said. Linger there for a moment in the visual. And now shifting to hearing, to sound. And if you like, even bringing awareness to the physical sensations of your ears. Deep inside the ears or around the edges, just to get that tactile sense. But then to the awareness of sound. Perhaps sounds nearby, sounds further away, maybe the sound of my voice. There may be pleasing sounds or unpleasant sounds, trying to stay just with the experience of hearing. Now shifting to the sense of smell, is there something that is stimulating the olfactory sense? Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. Noticing the presence or absence of any smell. And becoming aware of taste. What is or is not there? Do you like it? Do you not like it? Is it just more neutral? Just simply being aware that taste is possible. For some, it isn't. Just noticing. And now the sense of touch. Noticing all the places where the body is touching itself that you can perceive. Perhaps the touch of the eyelids, or the tongue in the mouth. Are the lips touching each other? Perhaps noticing the arms, the place on the insides of the upper arms, where they gently touch the side of the body. The hands and fingers and forearms, is there touch happening there? Perhaps the backs of the thighs and the base of the body, touching whatever you're sitting on or reclining upon. Noticing touch in the feet. And in this awareness of touch, you might notice a little detail. Is there pressure, pulsing, vibration? Something that is pleasant or unpleasant? Simply noticing. And the astonishing ability to have awareness of these different senses, consciousness itself. And then continuing into broadening the awareness to the elements, beginning with the earth element, the minerals and hardness, the solid structures of the body. Maybe clench the teeth a little bit to get a sense of that earth element, the teeth, the bone, or press the hands together and notice the bones in the hands. We are of this earth. And then the fire element, essential to our survival, having warmth, being able to cool off, noticing temperature as it touches your body, comfortable or uncomfortable, the presence of this fire element. And the air element, breathing in and breathing out, this fundamental exchange of oxygen and carbon dioxide with everything green that's alive. Without this element, we also can't exist. And lastly, the water element. Sometimes it's said that the water element is that which holds everything together. All the fluids in the body, blood and lymph and waste and tears and moisture in the skin, mucous membranes that we need to stay moist. The interstitial fluid, the fluid that's in between cells, that keeps cells bathed, alive, healthy. So I invite you now to choose one of the senses or one of the elements and get very close to it, experiencing whatever you choose as a way to be very present with this body at this time. And of course, the mind will wander somewhere else. And when it does, know that it is not a problem. It's completely natural. Just come back to that sense again, sense or element. Breathe and know your breathing. It might be that the air element, the experience of breathing, is right where you'd like to be. Or sound or touch, whatever works for you. And we'll sit quietly. noticing whatever is drawing your awareness. And if it is your object of meditation, stay with it. If it's not, if it's a distraction, see if you can imagine putting that on the back shelf or off to the side. And then any amount of stillness, quiet, calm, whatever word you want to use, that is arising just by sitting still, see if you can let that be in the forefront of your experience. Getting very close to the experience of the mind quieting, the body settling. Place your awareness there if you can. This is a poem from Mary Oliver called What the Body Says. I was born here, and I belong here, and I will never leave. The blue heron's gray smoke will flow over me for years, and the wind will decide all directions until I'm safely and entirely something else. I'm thinking of this winter morning as I sit by the fire and the fire in its red rack keeps singing its crackling song of transformation. Of course, I wonder about the mystery that is surely up there in starry space and how some part of me will go there at last. But I am talking now of the way the body speaks and the wind that keeps saying firmly, lovingly, a little while, and then this body will be stone, then it will be water, then it will be air. sensing this whole body right now, right here. Water, air, mineral, earth, all the senses being unabashedly right here, right now. And then expanding that awareness to all bodies everywhere, the commonality of living in a body in all its shapes and sizes, all its pain, all its pleasure. Expanding that out and offering a little bit of love, a little bit of compassion, beaming out this awareness of our common humanity and our common wish to be well out into the world. Okay, everybody, let's take 5 minutes, take a break, come back. Okay, welcome back. So based on the body, there is a body, and in this fathom-long body, we can learn everything that there is to be learned. We'll move into the second foundation of mindfulness, Vedana, V-E-D-A-N-A, which is commonly translated as feeling tone, which I've always thought is a little bit of an odd translation, because what does feeling tone really mean? I think of it as quality of experience, and you can do your own, whatever words work for you. But what it means is everything that we come in contact with, every single thing we experience has got a certain quality of pleasant to a little pleasant to not so pleasant to totally unpleasant. And sometimes there's a neutral in there. So things can be experienced as pleasant or not pleasant. Unpleasant or not unpleasant, whether it's comfortable or uncomfortable, whether we like it, whether we don't like it, anywhere along this whole spectrum. So it makes sense, right? I mean, we understand this conceptually, but what is it like to experience pleasant and unpleasant, or comfort and uncomfortable? So as we did that very tactile meditation, you may have had some opinions about it, or maybe there was a taste you noticed that was, oh yeah, I can still taste what I ate recently, and it was so delicious, and there's a little residue of that. Or it's opposite. You know, when you eat something that leaves a taste in your mouth that you don't care for, or the same thing with smell or sight or sound. Where is it on that big continuum line of really pleasant to really unpleasant? So we understand this continuum line, but less aware necessarily of the subtle ways in which it influences our experience, right? Because the thing about Vedana, it's a powerful doorway into understanding our experience, because consciousness itself, well, there is consciousness itself, we're just awake, but we project onto every situation, do we like it or not? And this is a pre-verbal place. You can come into a room and feel the energy in a room. Ooh, I want to be here. Ooh, there's something off. I don't want to be here. Or the experience of the fire element. You come into a room, it's a little cold, it's a little hot, a warm. But is the presence of cool or warmth in and of itself, is it a problem? Is it not a problem? It's what we project onto it. The fact that something is cool or warm is simply the fact that it's cool or warm, right? Some people talk about objects that we place value on, liking or disliking. The objects themselves are completely innocent. They're just the objects themselves. But what is our relationship to those objects? Our relationship to thirst or hunger? Does it have a quality of comfort, discomfort, pleasant or unpleasant? And most of our responses are habitual, right? Conditioned by our habits, conditioned by our culture. Anais Nin famously said, "We don't see the world as it is, we see it as we are." That's another one of those teachings that I keep coming back to over and over again, is what are my views and opinions, or what's actually happening here? Can I peel back these layers and suspend my loyalty to my opinions long enough to have a different view, to really have a different view? And this is the cool thing about mindfulness and mindful awareness, is that we can see, when we train in this, and we can see it in our meditation, how both pleasant, the experience of pleasant and unpleasant, comfort and discomfort, lead us down differing paths. We like something, we want more of it. We don't like something, we definitely tend to push it away. And this is a training of saying, oh, this is just how it is right now. It's cold, or it's warm, or whatever it is. So depending on whatever is present, it typically leads us to acceptance or rejection. And it's fast, right? It's lightning fast. And I know, my guess is you know this, but over and over again, we hear the invitation in this practice to meet whatever is here and to train in transforming reactivity into responsiveness. This is what we're doing over and over and over again. And I actually like hearing that teaching over and over again. Where is the reactivity? And not judging myself for being reactive, right? It's not about I should or shouldn't do this. This is about there are certain things that bring about some difficult automatic responses or reactions. And I would like to train in the pause, in the ability to say, I'm getting activated here. How do I want to respond? So it's very easy, I think, to experience pleasant and unpleasant, certainly in the presence of this body, right? We experience all of it. And we talked about that in our, in the metta, you know, the pain of living a human life, the joy of living a human life, all of the cycles of illness and wellness and illness and wellness. But where is that place of neutrality that we often hear about, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, or pleasant, unpleasant, or not pleasant, not unpleasant? And I once spent a long time practicing with neutral to see if I could figure out what was actually neutral. And from my own experience, the only way I could make sense of that is an object, you know, let's just say this glass of water is just a glass of water. But what does it represent? It represents some comfort to me, because if I'm thirsty, I can make that adjustment. Or sometimes it's just a glass of water, and I've had so much water, I don't want to see another glass of water. So then I may have a negative response to it. But what is neutral or innocent is actually, it's a glass that's made up of whatever glass is made of, and water that's come from the Mad River that I can have to nourish my body. But what I discovered in the practice of neutral is that I don't think there's very much that I experience. I mean, there are objects that are fundamentally neutral, right? And what I'm saying is, what do we project onto them? But my experience, I don't think I experience anything as purely neutral. And so I offer this to you as your own practice. If you feel like taking it on, start noticing in your life those things that are somewhere on the spectrum of just has a tinge of pleasant all the way to the most pleasant thing you can imagine. And it's opposite, something that has a little tinge of unpleasant to the most unpleasant thing that you could imagine experiencing or that you have experienced. Because that space of neutrality takes such an enormous amount of complete disengagement or really not paying attention, that what I have found for me is that I think that everything has a tinge of even a little bit of pleasant or a little bit of unpleasant, a little bit of comfort, a little bit of discomfort, because we're continually acclimating to our circumstances, right? Sweater on, sweater off, turn the heat up, turn the heat down, whatever it is, this chair, that chair. How many times a night do we turn over and take great pleasure in the underside of the pillow, turning that pillow over, right? The cool underside of the pillow, you're nodding. I mean, there is something that is supremely pleasant about that. And then I can go back to sleep. So we take these regular experiences and see what our relationship is to it through the experience of the body, through the experience of consciousness or the different senses. So, you know, this very, very famous quote from Viktor Frankl, between stimulus and response, there's a space. And in that space lies our freedom and power to choose our response. And in our response lies our growth and freedom. I want to talk about that space. We know that this is true, or we're taught that it's true, that between stimulus, contact, and how we respond to it, there's a little space where we train in noticing the space, because this is where we train in transforming reactivity into responsiveness. And I think what is in that space, so this is my question for us, what is in that space? I think it's everything is in that space. The body, the mind, the heart, the senses, the elements, our opinions, our lack of opinions, our pain, our comfort. It's all in there, our thoughts, our emotions. And primarily what is also in there is choice, agency, the ability to pause and say, what am I noticing? How do I want to respond? So this is where I want to bring in the Four Noble Truths. And I touched on this a little bit last time that I was here. I've been playing with this a lot. One of the things about the Dharma, you know, when I said at the very start that I like to think about what are the teachings that are supporting me, or what's happening in my life, and what are the teachings that I can apply to my life that help me make more sense of it. So any time that you find yourself thinking about these teachings and you get those moments of seeing how one thing is connected to another, to another, to another, and you let yourself get creative with what you've learned, you can, my experience, and I hope your experience, is that you start seeing the interconnection of all of these teachings, even though we have lists. The 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 or 7 of this and that. This is just how the Buddha taught, which is I experience as such a gift, because I'm a pretty methodical person. And I like the lists. I like that it gives me a framework. So here's how I want to talk about the Four Noble Truths with these foundations of mindfulness and how they're completely interconnected. So let's begin with the first noble truth that says life includes difficulty. Pain is part and parcel to living a life. Being alive is the first noble truth, that just because of the fact that we are alive in this body, we are going to experience challenge, stress, whatever word you want to use. And I know it's often translated as life includes suffering, but life includes challenge. Right there, that's the first noble truth. And now let's go to noble truth 1.5 and bring this in. So this is the part that I made up. Noble truth 1.5 is Vedana. Now, I didn't make up Vedana, but I'm inserting it here. Because the fact that we live in this body, in this life that includes challenge, or what we perceive to be challenge, because it is anxiety, stress, pain, this body may be in a lot of pain. Right there, there's that quality of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And so when we see the relationship to life includes difficulty, where on the spectrum is it? And this pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, actually we're talking about unpleasant right now. Or challenge, strain, stress, anxiety. This is why when we can see the connection of this first noble truth and how Vedana works, right there, we can insert choice also. So the first noble truth, life includes suffering. The second noble truth, life includes pain. The second noble truth, and there is a cause of our suffering, or difficulty happens and we tend to make it worse. Our response, the Vedana, and how we are in relationship with the Vedana influences the second noble truth that says we tend to make things worse. Or there's a cause of our suffering, the gripping, the pushing away. I want it to be like this and not like that. And because it's like that, I am in contention with this, making something more unpleasant. Are you with me on this? Yeah. So this is how I see how we go from the first noble truth, 1.5, Vedana exists. Vedana is real. We can experience Vedana all the time and our relationship to it. And then we see how it makes so much sense that when we resist what we perceive as unpleasant, it becomes suffering. It does. And we can say, lots of people, lots of teachers have defined suffering, Sylvia among them, the imperative in the mind that things be other than they are. Or Shinzen Young, pain plus resistance equals suffering. So that's a really good way to look at 1.5 and 2. Pain, first noble truth, plus resistance, the resistance to the difficult Vedana, noble truth number 2, here we get the suffering. So now the third noble truth says, and there is an end to the suffering. The mind can subside, or as Sylvia says, peace is possible. But how do we get from the suffering, the second noble truth, how am I going to get my mind to subside? This is the pith of this. Right? We're so caught because of everything. Because of everything. And this is what Viktor Frankl is talking about. Between stimulus and response, there's this space. And so you might think to yourself, all right, this sounds really good, that peace is possible, that suffering in this moment can subside, my mind can let go. But we need a lot of help to get from 2 to 3. So my favorite way, which I'll call Noble Truth 2.5, is to implement and employ the medicine of the heart. Right in there to say, oh, suffering is here. I'm having a hard time. I can't let go of that storyline. And that's because the brain has a negativity bias. Have you ever had the experience of repeating the story over and over and over of something that difficult that has happened that has a quality of maybe outrage to it? I can't believe it. I would guess that just about every one of us here has had that repetitive thought that says, I can't believe this thing happened. I can't believe he said, she said, I can't, right? So that, just that phrase, I can't believe, we're putting a wall up, just that right there. There's that, there's the resistance. But when we switch that to this thing happened and it's painful, right in that acceptance, I'm not talking about moral acceptance, I'm talking about the truth that, all right, this is what's happening, there's a freedom. Right in that moment of acknowledgement, Karen Mason Miller, who is a Zen teacher in Los Angeles, she said something like, this is what she said, freedom is instantaneous the moment we accept the way things are. That has been a really important teaching for me. Freedom is instantaneous the moment we accept the way things are. We need to meet what is happening. And this is where we bring in the heart, and to really trust the heart practices. It might be painful, but the heart practices of metta, wishing well for somebody else, for their well-being or our own. When the heart loves, the heart shows up. Or another heart practice of compassion. There's a difference between compassion and empathy. I think we feel empathy when it's something that we have also been through. Compassion, we don't have to have been through the same experience to have the heart be moved by pain, right? When we meet pain with love, that's compassion. When the heart is moved to say, how can I help? That's compassion. The heart responds. And so when we're caught in the dukkha and we bring in this medicine of the heart, immediately there's a little bit of resolution, a little bit of softening, and we can move into the third noble truth. Or the brilliance of mudita practice, appreciative joy, really feeling the joy of somebody else's success. What an uplifting thing. This is where the heart delights. The heart truly delights. And I hope you have all felt that. It's a powerful feeling in the moment of delighting in somebody else's great good fortune. Our own suffering is lifted because we're not thinking, we're not so absorbed in our own stuff, but we can actually feel the joy of somebody else's stuff. What a wonderful thing that is. So the heart delights. And then this place where the mind can subside, that's actually my favorite way of expressing the third noble truth. The mind subsides. The ich in the mind subsides. Like that experience of relaxing, that peace that can be equanimity, this fourth of the Brahma Viharas, where we get some perspective, capacity. Tatra maja tata, that word that I brought in at the beginning, there in the middleness, the ability to be with all of it, and the mind can subside. And we move into the third noble truth here. So we've come from the first one of pain, 1.5 being the Vedana of it, 2 being, okay, the dukkha is here, 2.5, bringing in the heart in all the different ways the heart can come in. And then we land in the third noble truth of ease, of subsiding. And then the Buddha, of course, taught the fourth noble truth as the path leading to the end of suffering, where we have all of these different practices, including the heart practices. So between stimulus and response, there's a space. And this space includes everything. And we are all training in these practices to be able to employ them as we need them. So I want to read you a piece. Actually, okay, we have 15 minutes. Before I do that, I want to talk about the brain a little bit so we have some context for what is happening in the brain with difficult Vedana. And I just want to share with you this piece of work from Richie Davidson. And Richie Davidson is a neuroscientist at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And he's done a tremendous amount of work over the last 50 years on what is happening in the brain of meditators. He was one of the first people to meet with His Holiness the Dalai Lama to study the brain of monastics. So he came up with this theory called the Unified Theory of the Happy Brain. And it's what he did is he's identified 4 independent brain circuits that influence our lasting well-being. I think this is fascinating. And what a great title, the Unified Theory of the Happy Brain. So these 4 different circuits that he's identified, one is our ability to maintain positive outlooks, positive states or that positive emotions directly impact the ability to experience happiness, our outlook, right? I mean, we can look out at things and see things glass half full, glass half empty. We all know this. But when we intentionally shift to, I'm going to notice something beautiful, I'm going to notice the good right now, that actually has a circuit in the brain that is responsible for that ability to shift our outlook, to reframe. The second is our ability to recover from negative or difficult states. That's resiliency, that capacity to bounce back. And all of us in this room can experience the same difficult experience, but have, you know, 35 different responses to it. Some of us will pop back easier than others. The same fender bender might really take me or you way out of our resiliency zone. It might take me a long time to come back to balance, or it might not. But each of us is going to have a different response to it because of our wiring. And this practice helps strengthen our wiring of resiliency. The third is our ability to focus and avoid mind wandering. So this is our meditation, right? This is concentration. We are training every single time we come back. We're training this over and over again. And interestingly, that there is an independent circuit in the brain that is responsible for our ability to do that, says Ritchie. And the fourth one, I love this one. There's an entire brain circuit devoted to responding to generosity. This is amazing. That when you are in the experience of either giving or receiving, and you are present with this, there's a circuit that lights up, that is stimulated, that is responsible for our feelings of goodness around generosity. Isn't that amazing? I mean, not only does it feel good to give, sometimes we have to train in receiving, but it's also why it feels good to watch somebody else be generous to somebody else, because we have these mirror neurons, and so it still stimulates that circuit. So I bring this in, and we could talk a lot about it, but again, a circuit for outlook, maintaining our ability to reframe a situation, a circuit for our resiliency, a circuit for concentration, a circuit for generosity. And this is why what we want to do is notice when things are okay. Notice contentment. Notice the absence of pain. Notice what else there is, because this helps us integrate there is a body. It helps us integrate the Vedana. So I want to read you a piece. This was in the New York Times a couple of days ago from the writer Margaret Rankel, and you can get this in the New York Times. Her last name is spelled R-E-N-K-L. It's called The Nature of Joy, and I want to read this to you. Last Sunday morning, I woke early to the most beautiful day in the history of the world, as my brother calls every day of his life. All around my yard, the world was renewing itself. I'd turned the sprinkler on my pollinator garden the day before, and sometime during the night, our newly resident armadillo had taken advantage of the damp soil nearby to dig a number of small holes in the mowed part of our front yard. I don't mind the holes. As with the loose soil turned up by moles, the pocked ground that armadillos leave behind makes a perfect landing place for wildflower seeds carried on the wind. During dry times, worms move deep below the surface, but they move up again when the soil is damp. Waking up to moist, newly turned soil is a gift to ground-feeding birds, and all around the yard, robins were monitoring the armadillo holes. One bird would cock an invisible ear toward the ground, and then another would do the same at a hole a few feet away, a concentration of robins listening and then plunging their yellow bills into the loose dirt, pulling out something juicy to feed their babies. While I was watching the robins from our living room window, a tiny cottontail emerged from the depths of the pollinator garden. The wee rabbit would take a bite of clover and then leap straight up. It would take a bite of violet and then dash madly around the circumference of the pollinator bed, leaping and twisting in midair. I can't tell you how much delight I take in watching a young animal's deep pleasure in existence, enjoying the power of its beautiful young body in a beautiful old world. When I open the door to let the dog out to pee in the small part of our yard that's fenced, a Carolina wren shot out from the mesh bag where we store our clothespins. Carolina wrens are famous for building nests in peculiar places, often in proximity to human beings, so I hurried Rascal back inside and stood at the door to watch the wren couple bringing leaves and pine straw to the mesh bag. Sometimes they took turns, sometimes they climbed in together, so busy the whole clothesline bounced up and down. Once the day warmed up, our resident broadhead skink returned from wherever she had been guarding her eggs and reclaimed her spot on the front stoop. Years ago, for father's sake, my husband built a ramp up our front door and covered it with old roofing shingles. We could safely remove the ramp now. My father-in-law died 2 years ago, but those shingles absorb heat in a way that is greatly appealing to lizards, and I love watching the lizards. Our longtime broadhead is often joined by a juvenile five-lined skink. Both skinks have a scar that marks the place where they once lost a tail in escaping from a predator. The five-lined skink looks to have regrown more than one tail. Its scars are overlapping. If you could watch skinks taking the afternoon sun, you would have no trouble understanding that wild creatures take great pleasure in the world. So how do we reframe that animals dig up the lawn and it's a place to grow wildflowers? It's a place for worms to come back up. How integrated we are with this earth, and what do we project onto what's mine, what's not mine? Who has a right to be here, who doesn't? Can we just be with what is in these moments? All of the bodies of these animals, the bodies of the earth, our bodies, this vast integration. To wake up every day to the most beautiful day in the history of the world. That's the name of our talk today. The most beautiful day in the history of the world. There is a body. We have a relationship to this body and a relationship to our lives. And we can choose. We can choose about this relationship. Thank you, everybody. Such a pleasure to be with you here today. I'll be back in about a month. Come join me with anything I do anytime. And know that your pain matters, your joy matters, your body is exactly as it is. Make friends with it, love it. We need each other. And we offer up the benefit and the goodness of our practice to all beings, so all of this suffering can be eased, so people have enough to eat and shelter, can move out of war zones if they can, be part of a welcoming community, even if it's in a war zone. May everybody be peaceful and happy and come to the end of suffering. Thank you, everyone. See you next time. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.